one. So let's get underway. I put the link in the chat for the source sheet once again. Welcome to Wills and the Jewish Client. I want to thank the Bayit and Shari Shamayim for partnering on this program. And Shai Shemaim in particular would have hosted this if we were able to do it in person. I look forward to be able to go back to being in person. I am not recording video, so you can feel free to turn on your camera and, you know, even if you're eating dinner, you know, no one's going to judge. We are accredited for 1.5 professionalism hours by the Law Society of Ontario. Please make sure that you sign in the Zoom chat. Even if you pre-registered, I still need you to sign in if you want a letter certifying that you participated. Also, if you're here and you did not register, but you want information about future legal ethics classes, make sure to sign in as well. This is going to be a discussion of issues of wills. Which, you know, is a topic that is of interest to people, I think, very broadly. And I want to make sure to make clear that for practical guidance, you should please consult your rabbi. Each case can be different, and drafting is complicated, so make sure you consult lawyer and rabbi in order to get it done right. We're going to be talking about multiple views, and I'm certainly not poskening anything for anybody. I also want to ask for help from family lawyers. The next session that we have, I believe, is Sunday, December 12th, and our topic is going to be shepherding families through family law litigation. And what I'm looking for are the thoughts of family lawyers on what should be included here. What is it that people should know? How can we best help families through that experience? So I will ask again, anyone here who's in family law, please send me an email and share your thoughts with me, and hopefully it will make for a better session. I can share them in your name or not in your name, as you choose. So you may want to let me know which one you choose. So if you take a look at the source sheet, and I'm going to put the link in the chat again for the source sheet. I'm going to mute everybody by default. Hello, David. Thank you for sending that to me. I didn't get to answer yet, but I did see it. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
I put at the top of the sheet that our accreditation comes in relation to Rule 2.4 in the Rules of Professional Conduct. Recognizing and being sensitive to clients' circumstances, special needs, and actually it's not Rule 2.4, sorry, it's 2.4 on the Law Society's list of topics to cover. Sorry, recognizing and being sensitive to clients' circumstances, special needs, and intellectual capacity, e.g. multicultural language, gender, socioeconomic status, demeanor. The point being that there are questions which come up in the context of wills for Jews specifically, and observant Jews as well, although not only observant Jews. And that's really what we want to address. As I put in the bullet points there, how can traditional Jews living in Canadian society prepare a modern will without running afoul of Jewish law's traditional invalidation of a posthumous bequest? And what is the position of Jewish tradition regarding disinheriting an heir, and how should that be handled in the context of Canadian law? Some of you may have been there. I think some of you were there. I spoke on this topic 6 years ago, almost to the day, at the Bayit on a Sunday morning. And at the time, I had a lot of help, I believe, if I remember correctly, from Chuck Wagner and Rachel Blumenfeld. And I appreciate the help they gave me then. Not everything that I said then is going to be said tonight. Not everything I say tonight is going to be said then. Nonetheless, it really did have an impact on the session. So thank you very much. I gave you three vignettes at the start of the sheet. I'm not going to read them aloud right now. They relate to the points that we've already raised of how traditional Jews can prepare a modern will. And the issue of disinheriting, we'll take them one by one as we get to them. But two topics that I'm not going to discuss, but definitely ought to be mentioned. I gave you bullet points for them on the sheet with links to recordings of classes of mine that are relevant. Number one, wishes that oppose halakha. What if somebody wants to put in a will that they should be cremated? So is a lawyer who observes Jewish law able to help with that? And I gave you a link to a class from 2017 on helping a client violate Jewish law. And then also I was asked about litigating a will in secular court. It's a great topic, also beyond the scope of what we'll get to tonight. But I gave you a link to a session that I gave on litigation in secular court in general. Okay, so in terms of writing a will, by way of introduction on this, Judaism overall values writing a will. It's not considered a good idea for somebody to say, don't worry about it, it's ayin hara, I don't want to do it because maybe that's, asking for trouble. That's generally speaking not a way that Jewish tradition looks at writing a will. We may write it carefully, and a person might say to their lawyer, God forbid anything should happen, and so on. But nonetheless, we advocate for writing wills. First of all, Jewish history has a strong tradition of ethical wills. The Makor Chaim commentary on the Munkacher's ethical will records that Rav Shlomo Kluger said you should write a will at age 50, specifically. So I'm not sure if he was talking financial or ethical there. Ethical will meaning a set of instructions to one's family for how to live life. Not about disposition of financial assets, but about how to live. So he said one should do that at the age of 50, and his basis for saying it is a biblical verse, which says, in the Jubilee year, which is a 50-year cycle, in the Jubilee year, each person will return to his portion of land. The idea being that ancestral land that is sold off is supposed to be restored to the family in year 50. So he says that's when you're supposed to write a will. It's about a family, it's about family property. Sounds like he means a financial will, even though it's recorded in the context of an ethical will. There are other sources that are brought to support it, but that's number one. Is this tradition that 50 years old in particular is a good time? Second, the default system which will be applied in the event that there is no will is not going to be consistent with the Torah's system of inheritance, and it's not going to be consistent with Jewish values. So if it matters to somebody that that their assets be distributed in accordance with the laws of the Torah, then they're going to have to do something. If they don't act, it ain't going to happen. The Torah gives us the order of inheritance in Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 27, verses 8 to 11. I brought you the implementation of it in part in source number one, on the sheet, in terms of one's sons and daughters. If you take a look there from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, and I'm just reading out my English, not the original Hebrew. You can see the Hebrew there as well, though. When a person dies, leaving sons and daughters, the sons inherit all of the property, and they feed their sisters until they mature or are betrothed. The system is that the sons inherit, and the daughters receive support. The males are the ones who inherit because they have responsibility for others. The idea being that historically, not the modern age clearly, but historically, the males in the family were the ones who would go out and earn a living, and so they're the ones who would receive the property. And the text in the Code of Jewish Law goes on to say, this system in which the sons inherit and they support their sisters only applied if there was enough property to feed the sons and the daughters. However, in the event that there isn't enough to feed the sons and the daughters, then the daughters are the ones who get the property and the sons get whatever's left. And in the event that there isn't enough to have anything left for the sons, well, too bad. So records the Code of Jewish Law based on the Talmud. Well, if anyone has any vision of satisfying anything like this, it ain't gonna work unless you do something with a will. So first of all, we value leaving instructions. And number two, we're concerned about what's gonna happen if we don't leave instructions. Number three, if one doesn't write a will which conforms with Jewish law, then I'll say it the opposite way. You're probably aware that there are authorities in Jewish law who do not recognize a secular will as effective in terms of halakha from the standpoint of Jewish law. And according to them, any attempt by heirs to take property that Jewish law would not have given to them actually constitutes theft. So if a person doesn't write a will, they are potentially causing their heirs to stumble in the laws of theft. So that's a third concern. And then the last concern is one that I actually saw in an article from Chuck, which is that there are non-financial issues involved, issues like custody of children. And in the event that a will is not written to address things like that, there could be all sorts of problems, for which reason, by the way, waiting till the age of 50 is probably not a good idea, because some of these are issues which, God forbid, could become very relevant for a family long before that. So this is just basic sort of background on why, from a Jewish law perspective, we would really encourage people to write wills. Clear on that part? We're good? Okay. I just put the link in the chat again because I see more people have joined. I'm also going to reiterate, because of those people who had joined, if you want to get a letter certifying that you were here, please, please make sure to send me a message in the chat confirming that you're here. Otherwise, I will not be able to do so. Okay, so let's move into our first vignette. Looking back at the sheet, the first vignette towards the top of side one. David, an observant Jew, prepared a will in accordance with local law, distributing his property among his children equally and ignoring any considerations of Jewish law. He did a regular, normal will, the same you'd see from anybody else. His daughter Sarah declares that she will refuse to accept any property bequeathed to her under the terms of this will. She says, well, that doesn't fit Jewish law. I'm not taking the property. I don't want to be guilty of theft. Under Jewish law, is Sarah correct? Is a secular will ineffective in the eyes of Jewish law? That's our opening question. What would you say? Thoughts on this question. Is Sarah right for refusing?
Rabbi Feinstein says that you can rely on the will.
So we're going to get to Rabbi Feinstein's view. And indeed, you are correct, David. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein seems to support the use of such a will. Sorry? I didn't hear. Somebody was saying something. Oh, okay. So I overheard somebody's voice is very low on here, but somebody said, Dina de Machusa, Dina, the law of the land is the law. So that's actually going to be our starting point here. You could argue that a secular law should be acceptable. We do have a principle in Jewish law of Dina de Machusa, Dina, the law of the land is the law. And so even if Jewish law wouldn't necessarily accept this, nonetheless, secular law recognizes it, the government recognizes it, so therefore it should be considered a valid gift. So let's start with what the problem is. Sorry? Right, so you don't sound, I think I know who that is. Is that Batalo? Oh, Shia. Okay, sorry. So Shia points out that there are limits to what we will accept as the law of the land. So let's take it step by step. The problem we face when dealing with a secular will overall is what's called in Hebrew matana la'achar misa, which means a posthumous gift. In Jewish law, a gift requires an act of transaction in order for it to take effect, what we call in Hebrew a kinyan. You have to do something that affects the transaction. Different types of property are communicated with different acts of transaction, but you need a gift, you need an action in order to do it. If somebody declares that property should be given posthumously to somebody else without an act of kinyan, that doesn't work, because once a person passes away, they are no longer able to communicate their property to somebody else. This is a passage in the Gemara, Gittin, Daf Yud Gimel, and so is brought in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law. If you take a look at source number 3, if a healthy person says, record a deed, this field to X, no mention of death, just in general, he says, I want you to write up a document assigning my field to so-and-so. And while he is alive, they can record it and give. And it's valid, so long as he doesn't recant before the deed reaches X's hand. So if I own a piece of land, and I tell people, do me a favor, draft a document, assign my field to so-and-so, and they do, it goes to so-and-so, that's valid. The transfer of the document works. However, after his death, once that person who wants to give the property, the donor, passes away, they do not record a deed and transfer the field. Then at that point, they can't do that anymore. Unless he enacted a kinyan with them while he was alive. Unless he performed an act of transaction to seal that while he was still alive. But otherwise, it doesn't work. The gift has to be given while still alive. That's the way that this works. And the problem is that the way a secular will is done, that's not happening. So some will argue, and this is the question that was raised by somebody here, I think it was Moshe, Dina de Machusa, law of the land. The law of the land does not require that you enter into a kinyan, into a transaction at the time of the gift. So I don't care if the government is okay with it, Jewish law is not. The other way around. The government is okay with it. It doesn't matter that Jewish law is not. However, there are a few responses to this. First of all, I brought you in source number 4, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, also known as the Rashba. And the Rashba says, this does not work. He says, if you look at source number 4, the English is at the top of the second side. To deduce from this, meaning from the principle of obeying government legislation, to follow the ways of the nations and their laws. He says, God forbid that this holy nation act thus. All the more so if they will now increase their sin, uprooting the portion of a father upon his children, depending upon this fragile reed, meaning depending on the principle that the law of the land is binding. One who does this tears down the walls of the Torah, uproots root and branch, and the Torah will demand recompense from his hand. He says, absolutely not. And one who increases his wealth thus will stumble in his own deeds. And I say that any who rely on saying this is permitted because we must obey the law of the land is mistaken and a thief. He uproots all the laws of the complete Torah. He says, why would I need the Talmud anymore? Just go learn the laws of the nations. I don't need Judaism anymore. I can just, follow that. He says, absolutely not. Now, in the excerpt that I brought you, he makes his position very, very clear that he's not willing to accept law of the land on this. What he has not done is explain why. So at one point he does make a comment, which I didn't bring in my excerpt here, where he explains the following. The idea that the law of the land is the law is predicated on the law being for the benefit of society. The Hebrew or the Aramaic phrase, Dina de Malchusa Dina, the law of the empire, of the nation, is the law. However, he says, what we're talking about here is not for the good of the nation, it's just the king's law. That's all it is. It's Dina de Malka. So he says the whole principle of the law of the land is the law doesn't apply to such legislation. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasim Sofer, came along and explained very succinctly why this doesn't work. He says the whole principle here is irrelevant because this is a gift between Jews. And a gift between Jews, the government doesn't care how you do things. As long as you give the king's cut, the king doesn't care what you do among yourselves. He's not trying to apply his law. If you look in source number 5, the king will take his share. Why will he care if the rest goes to the husband or to other heirs? It's not an issue for him. There are more reasons that are brought to challenge the idea that you could legitimately say the law of the land covers it. So that argument doesn't necessarily get taken. However, as David pointed out, there are those who argue a secular will works under a different point. And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein definitely is the most major voice to take this position publicly. He says, if you take a look at source number 6, logically, in my humble opinion, a will like this, I'm sorry, let me just give you the context for it. The question he's dealing with is, tzedakah organizations that receive bequests. That's what he's dealing with. He says those bequests are often drafted in a secular will. Is it appropriate for a tzedakah organization to accept a donation that comes to them via a secular will? That was what he was asked. So he says, logically, in my humble opinion, a will like this, which certainly would be upheld in accordance with the words of the person who issued it under the law of the land, should not require an act of kinyan. There could be no greater kinyan. The argument he makes is that the reason why I need an act of transaction in order to say that a gift designated while alive should be given posthumously is because otherwise we don't know that it's going to happen. The gift has not been cemented, so to speak, until you do an act of transaction. But he says if you write it up in a document that the government recognizes, you know it's going to be carried out. We all know that wills get litigated. Nonetheless, he says, doesn't make a difference. This is a legally binding mechanism. That's good enough. And he says that's the justification for accepting a bequest that comes in a secular will. He says that would be how it works. And in fact, if you take a look at source number 7, the work the Mar'eh HaBazak of Kolel Eretz Chemda in Israel has a footnote in a piece on secular wills in which it says, as I translated here in number 7, it was also communicated to us by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein that his father-in-law, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, arranged his will according to the law of the land. That the Rav Soloveitchik did not have a halachic will. And I looked into this at one point and had it corroborated by others as well, that he did not use a halachic will. Having said that, many halachic authorities did not accept Rav Moshe's position, even though Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was, without a doubt, the leading authority in Jewish law in North America from the 50s until his death in 1986. Nonetheless, his peers did not, or I don't know if I should call them peers, but others did not accept Rav Moshe's position. If you take a look at source number 8, this is from an article by Rabbi Chaim Jachter and Martin Schenkman, who is a lawyer. I'm going to refer off and on to articles by Rabbi Jachter. Rabbi Jachter is a rabbi and an authority in Jewish law who lives in New Jersey, and he has written in a few different places on the topic of inheritance. He's a great read. I always recommend reading him. By the way, I'll note now, since I didn't mention it before, at the end of your sheets, I gave you a bibliography for where you can find some excellent articles online, including Rabbi Jachter's writings. So for those who want more information, you can see it there. So source number 8, he says, Rav Moshe's ruling aroused great opposition. Dayan Aryeh Leib Grossness of the London Beth Din penned a thorough critique of Rav Feinstein's ruling. The authorities who concur with Dayan Grossness include Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Rav Yevil Cohn, Rav Ezra Batsri, Rav Herschel Schechter, and Rav Mordechai Willig. So that's a pretty good spectrum of halachic authorities who did not accept the idea that the fact that the law of the land recognized it substitutes for a kinyan, for a transaction. Furthermore, several classical commentaries disagree with Rav Moshe, including Chasam Sofer, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. All of these authorities reject the conclusion of Rav Moshe and would not sanction the use of a secular will without supplements. So the answer to the question in vignette number 1 is Rabbi Moshe Feinstein would say to David, you're fine, your will works. And he would say to Sarah, accept the money, you're fine. And great halachic authorities have gone that route. Apparently, Rav Soloveitchik went that route. Nonetheless, not everybody is happy with this. Not everybody is comfortable with it. And as a result, the client may want to consider writing a halachic will if the client has an heir who is observant. You don't want a situation in which there's a problem within the family and the heir is uncomfortable claiming the assets because it was done with a secular will. Clear so far? Yes, Chuck.
Question.
Yep.
Following proposition, I'd like your comment on it, and that's that any valid gift there are those who hold that any valid gift under Ontario law would be a valid gift in accordance with religious Jewish law, and that's based on Siman 201 in the Shulchan Aruch. Let me just put it in the chat.
Sure.
Is that a correct understanding of Simon 201?
It depends on what you're referring to. If you're referring to what Ramosha is saying, then the answer is yes. There are those who do accept it.
But is that what Simon 201 is saying? That it's valid in Ontario, it's valid on the halacha?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I do not think so. I'm calling up Simon 201 here so that I can share it with everybody else. Hang on, and then you'll be able to see the difference. Okay, I'm going to share screen with what Chuck is talking about. I don't have an English translation of it here, but this way you could at least see the original that he's talking about. What Chuck is talking about here is the question of what works as an act of kinyan. Are people able to see that? Did it materialize on your screen? It's talking about what works as an act of kinyan, as an act cementing a transaction. And what it says is, if there's a particular practice that people have to secure a transaction, and it's not one of the standard types of transaction that are listed in Jewish law, it's its own thing, but it's what everybody does, that works as an act of kinyan. So specifically, the part that I'm highlighting here, the minag medina hu sheyikneh haroshem kinyan gamur nikneh hamekach. You know what? The computer does not want me to do this. It's saying low system resources may affect your audio quality. So I'm going to stop sharing. But the point is that what Chuck is quoting says that acts of transaction are valid if they're acts which everybody recognizes. However, here, when a person writes a will, they're not performing a transaction. The transaction isn't happening until after they're deceased. And so the fact that 201 says acts of transaction that are valid in secular practice count as acts of transaction in Jewish law doesn't help. You follow, Chuck? 201 doesn't...
I follow. I don't know that I agree. I follow.
Okay.
The act of testamentary disposition in Ontario law is a valid disposition, even if things are set in...
Right, but that's not about being a transaction. Those are two different things. 201 is only talking about what constitutes an act of transaction. It does not talk about which types of transactions work. It's just about the act that cements a transaction. Let me say it a little bit differently, and this may be more clear, and then we're going to have to go further. If Jewish law, let's pretend for the moment, if Jewish law were to say that it is invalid to sell somebody fish on Fridays, okay? Let's say Jewish law had a rule that says you can't sell fish on Fridays. And in secular law, they said transactions are sealed with a handshake. Even if I tried to sell someone fish on a Friday with a handshake, Jewish law still would not recognize that sale is valid because we don't accept sales of fish on Fridays. That's just the way it is. I don't care that you performed an action which everybody recognizes as a transaction. It's that we have a system that says you can't do this transaction. It doesn't matter what act you do. And that's the same thing for trying to give a gift posthumously. Our ways of dealing with a problem are by changing the gift so that it's no longer a posthumous gift. Not by saying, well, it's a posthumous gift with a type of cementing act of kinyan that will be accepted. What Rav Moshe was doing was simply saying the kinyan occurred while still alive. That was Rav Moshe's way of dealing with it. Okay. So let's move to... Yes. One second. I've got too many voices. Alan first, because I saw you.
I think your example is defective. What if the guy shook hands on Thursday?
Yeah.
And said, I'm going to deliver the fish on Friday.
That's great.
On Thursday.
That's perfect.
Before I die.
Yeah.
I made the kin. Why even accept the fact that that was the kinyan? It just doesn't take effect until after I'm dead.
Because in the fish case, you actually did the transaction on Thursday. It's only delivery that's happening on Friday. In the case of the will, the property is not being given until after they're deceased. And I don't just mean delivery. think of the tax consequences. Are you really claiming that this property is given while the person is still alive? That's going to trigger all sorts of problems. Are we going to actually talk about that? That's going to be one of the methods of dealing with it, is to say, give the gift while still alive. But as we'll see, people generally don't want to do it. So that's the difference between the two approaches.
This isn't a righteous fact based on them. The problem is Shrikas Das, that people aren't from the Das. You find in the Shrikas Das to make a shruva, back up what you're saying, that you will do it, that's good enough. So really what the Rosh is saying is that Nira Makusa works as well as a shruva does. You can rely on it. Because the only issue is Shrikas Das, that people don't rely on it. Dabba Shalom Dabba El means there's no Shrikas Das. We can't rely on it. We don't see it in front of us. So therefore, we can't do so. But to deal with the problem,
right, so it's not the only issue, and I don't think that that's the only thing that Ramosha is addressing there. I'd want to talk about it more, but I really do. I'm looking at the clock, and we're after 8, and we've got a lot still to cover. So I'm going to put that on hold. If we get time at the end, we can come back to it, but I know we won't, so I don't want to promise you that. Yes, thank you. Otherwise, it'll be a smachta. So, our second vignette is simply an outgrowth of the first. We already said David made a secular will. Sarah is not willing to accept what she's supposed to get under the secular will. So David wishes to appease Sarah. How might he prepare a legal will which conforms to Jewish law? That's our major question, the question of questions, and it's what we're going to spend the bulk of our time on. So, there is a possibility of just instructing prospective heirs to do as the parents wish and forgive their rights. So in other words, David has 3 kids. David says to all of them, listen, I know Jewish law would have you get this and you get this and you get that, but I want to do things differently in my will, so if you could all just forgive it to each other, then there's no theft when each of you takes whatever you're going to get under the will, and that's that. That's a pretty insecure option, though. Relying on people's goodwill, I'm talking to a group of 63 lawyers, or lawyer screens at any rate. If the world really operated that way, you'd have a lot less work. The idea to justify that kind of an approach could be, we have a principle of mitzvah lekayim divrei hames. There is a mitzvah of fulfilling the words of the deceased. So you'll say, well, that means they have to. They don't have a choice. If the deceased asks them, you know, they're dying, they're planning this should go here and there, they should all observe it, then that should work. However, number one, the mitzvah to fulfill the words of the deceased does not apply to minors. That's first of all. Number two, it might only apply where the assets are being held in escrow by a third party while the donor is still alive. And Rabbi Jachter writes about that. But that's a second and very significant concern. So this isn't necessarily going to work. It may work, Rabbi Jachter notes, for designation of beneficiaries, for life insurance, RRSPs, and that kind of thing. There it may be effective. So, but again, bigger picture, there's nothing binding them from a secular perspective. They could choose to not follow it, and you're out of luck. Similarly, there's a mitzvah of honoring one's parents. So the children should just do what the parent told them to do, which always happens. So we have absolutely no concerns if you rely on that for the will. That's totally going to work. There's another principle of gifts that are called deathbed gifts in Jewish law, the gift of what's called a shchiv mera. But that will only apply to gifts that are actually assigned on somebody's deathbed. So none of these are really viable solutions. You don't build your practice on any of these. So we're going to move into the solutions that have been suggested and their pros and cons. The first type of gift that we'll mention is a future inter vivos gift with retained life interest, which is discussed in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law in source number 9. Rabbi Yosef Karo says, if one writes his property to his children, quote, after his death. So he says it's going to be his children's after he dies, but he's saying it now. The physical item belongs to the child from the date on the document. Chuck, this is what you were talking about trying to do, as I understand what you were trying to do, via Choshen Mishpat 201. And Alan, in terms of your understanding of the fish case, that's what this is. The physical item belongs to the child from the date on the document. Any product of that belong to the father until his death. And so what that means is that the father is not able to sell the physical item while he's still alive, because it belongs to the kid. And the kid can't sell the physical item because it's still in the father's domain until the father dies. This is not the same thing as joint tenancy. We're going to talk about that. But this is, the father still has an interest in the item while still living. If somebody...
tax consequences?
Hey, Joey. We're going to talk about the tax consequences shortly. I'm not missing that. But first, if somebody wants to do this, you have to use language that clearly indicates that the gift is taking place from now and not later on, not posthumously. I brought you in source number 10 from Donna Lippman and Professor Steven Reznikoff, Jewish and American Inheritance Law, very worth reading. I recommend it. It's in the bibliography at the end of the source sheet. The transfer of a future interest also requires that the kinyan, this transaction, be accompanied by appropriate language. Thus, a transferor who wants to retain beneficial ownership until just before death could state or include in any deed, "This transfer is from now until one moment before I die." By this language, the transferor will retain the right to possession of the property until the moment before death, when that right will vest in the transferee. Because at the transferor's death, the property belongs completely to the transferee, the transferor's Torah heirs receive nothing.
This is different than the previous one you just...
What do you mean?
Well, the first one was an inter vivos transfer taking effect now with the person retaining a life interest.
Yeah, that's what's going on here.
No, this sounds like it's happening a moment before death.
Right, but he's saying that he has this retained interest in it until then. No?
Yeah, but I don't think there's an actual transfer to the kids either until then.
Oh, right? No transfer. No, I see what you're writing, but I see what you're saying, I should say. But I don't think that was what they intended there. I think what they intended there was that the transaction starts now, as written. This transfer is from now until one moment.
Well, I can tell you most halachic wills I see.
Oh, they don't use this.
What?
Halachic wills don't use this. This is a method, but no one uses it.
Right. The halachic wills are all what I thought you were describing.
Okay.
The gift takes effect moment before death.
Right. No, we're going to get there. We're going to get to that. The idea here is that it takes effect immediately and irrevocably, unless one incorporates a specific declaration to make it revocable. In order to do this, a kinyan is required. You have to do an act of transaction, which can be tricky. As Rabbi Ronald Warburg notes, different types of property require different acts of transaction. Not so straightforward. But the problems with this include, from a secular perspective, you need to make sure, obviously, that the gift is executed in a way that the state recognizes. If it's a charitable gift, it has to be irrevocable, otherwise this will not be honored. And, as Joey noted, there may be tax consequences for the recipient, because now the basis is earlier, right? The gift was given at a certain moment in time, that becomes their basis for the property. If you take a look at source number 11, the top of the next side, Rachel Blumenfeld writes, "There are a number of practical and legal drawbacks to this solution, not the least of which is the loss of control by the donor over his or her property, because you started giving it away earlier. As well, there would be tax consequences to the transfer. If there is an accrued gain realized on the disposition, unless the property is a principal residence. If the donor does wish to proceed with a transfer of this nature, it is important to document what is to occur if, for example, the donor is unable to continue living in the property." That's a whole other problem that you have with this. So there are versions of this with stipulations to work around the problems, but there are better ways to do this. The most common approach that I have seen is what's called the artificial debt approach. There are a couple of variations to this. I'm going to start with the basic form. In source number 12, Rabbi Yosef Karo, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, one who obligates himself to pay another person unconditionally is obligated even if there was no debt. In other words, not in the context of wills, but in general. If somebody stands up in front of witnesses or writes a document that says they owe somebody else money, I don't care whether there was a loan, I don't care whether there was no loan, it doesn't matter. You're now bound to fulfill what you agreed to. You said you owe somebody money, pay up. One who says to witnesses, I want you to witness that I owe X a mana, a measure of currency, or one who writes in a deed, I owe X a mana, even without witnesses, because they have a document. Or one who says to X in front of witnesses, a deed says that I owe you a mana, is obligated, even without saying to the witnesses, you are my witnesses. He has obligated himself as one who obligates himself to be a guarantor, just like you become a guarantor on a loan. No one ever gave you anything. And yet, you're on the hook for it. So too here, you agreed to the artificial debt. I'm grateful to the COR for sharing with me. They have a halacha institute, which helps people with financial issues. So they shared with me the contract that they use for wills, and they use this method as well, a version of this method, I should say. I'm not actually sharing that material in my materials because it's something that really requires being drafted with someone who knows what they're doing in order to fill it out. So it's not like it's just, hey, fill in the blank with your name and you're done. But they use a version of this method as well. You need two witnesses and you need a document or a verbal declaration. And the way it works, applying this to wills, because I haven't actually gone anywhere yet. I just explained that there's such a thing as an artificial debt. But the way it works is that the writer of the will says, I owe X amount of money to so-and-so unless the heirs do what I say with the estate, in which case they will forgive the debt. The debt is considered discharged. So I owe Reuven $50 million Canadian dollars. How, and it's payable an hour before my death. However, Reuven has agreed that in the event that we dispose of my assets in the way recorded in the will, then Reuven will forgive the claim of the $50 million. That's the idea in an artificial debt. Some will require an act of kinyan as well, so that it's not what's called an asmachta. In other words, in general, in Jewish law, we don't want people to take on obligations which are not serious obligations. So, for example, let's pretend I'm a contractor on some building project, and the person I'm working for says, I don't think this is going to get done on time. I'm worried that this deal is not going to be executed properly or whatever it is. I'm worried that you won't build what you're supposed to build. And I say to them, if I don't come in on time, I owe you $1 million. So depending on the size of the project, but if it's a small project, we assume that I was exaggerating. It's what's called in Jewish law an asmachta. I never intended to actually make good on it, and you knew that I was never going to make good on it. So maybe in this case, where I write in my will that I owe somebody $50 million, you'll look at that and say, come on, Torchino hasn't seen $50 million in his life. What are you talking about? So we may require an act of kinyan, which will solve that problem. It demonstrates seriousness. Are we clear on how that works? I still have to talk about some drawbacks and nuances, but that's the basic idea. Are we clear on how that works?
Who do you make Reuven?
So the answer can be a separate party. I'm going to talk about that. It could even be one of the heirs, and we'll talk about that as well. That's one of the nuances.
But what happens to someone, the family is going to fight for spite? They'll say, okay, I'm not going to go along with it. You owe the $50 million.
Well, the person who wrote the will isn't going to care. So fine.
He's not going to care.
He's gone.
Yeah, but he's not going to get there. But
what he's intending to do, but with this mechanism will not necessarily be carried out.
It's an interesting point that you're making. You're right. In other words, one of the heirs could cause this to crash and burn.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we'll say one of the heirs is wealthy and doesn't need the money. The other ones do. And they hate each other.
Right.
I've seen enough of siblings hating each other.
Right, well, that's the family law discussion that I had in the beginning. But yes, vulnerable to sabotage is an interesting point. Unless you write it in such a way that you account for that and say, well, not if members of the family, you know, some severability type of a clause to avoid that problem, perhaps. Yes, Chuck.
I would like to hear from you and some of the estate planners. Size of the estate, it may reduce the amount of taxes you have to pay, and there's a liability that may, including criminal sanctions, that may fall on estate planners who put a bogus debt that won't be recognized in Ontario law. So if you want to take it seriously, what advice do you have to those planners? Whether to include this mechanism or not, if it's real, if there are problems for me in that way. Like, would anybody here on this thing say, I have this artificial debt, so we reduce the estate by $1 million, so let's pay less probate?
No, because Chuck, you can't deduct any debts other than ones that are registered on title.
In title.
First of all, you wouldn't get anyway for probate. But also, I think the whole point is that it's a bogus debt for Canadian purposes. It's not a bogus debt for halachic purposes.
Correct.
That's the whole point. It doesn't exist under Canadian law. Canadian law doesn't recognize pledges without consideration, right? It doesn't have any
well, we're
under Canadian law. It only has teeth under halachic.
So I'm gonna talk about consideration. But Rachel, what were you gonna say? Yeah.
No, I was gonna say, could you argue that it's made under seal because
you've got Kirk versus Kirk, you wouldn't be able to do it. Take a look at
Kirk
versus
Kirk.
It's just,
Raquel's right.
It's a
bogus. I wouldn't be the one to do it. I would have the rabbi do it, and I wouldn't put it in the will, and I would say don't put it under seal in a way that's going to be enforceable under Canadian law.
One second. Sorry, folks. I have a mute all button. I may use it. So a couple of things. First of all, in terms of doing it as a separate document, I think that's a very important point, and I wasn't going to say it because I forgot to. So thank you for pointing out making it a separate document is important for not just this, but for some of the other things. We're going to come back to the question of something that's not valid under secular law and its acceptability in halacha. The answer in short is that's good enough. But we'll talk about that. Abby. You've been waiting very patiently.
Sorry, I was going to say that Chuck actually raised a good point about it being, and you meant both it going towards probate, and you mentioned actually that it should be a separate document. Because I was going to say it would be very interesting to see if it became part of a will. At one of the pages of the will, do you have to probate that?
Right.
And then once it's probated, it's a public document, and anyone can see it, including CRA or whoever else, and then they're going to wonder what that is.
Right. I'm going to come back. Yeah, again, I am going to come back to that very shortly. But for those who want to look ahead, it's source number 17. So either way. Okay. Raquel, Rachel, Abby, have you said what needs to be said? Thank you. Good. So in terms of... in terms of this approach, a couple of drawback issues. First of all, we might require that the artificial debt be a specific amount of money and not just, let's say, a percentage of the estate. And this is something that comes down to an apparent debate between Maimonides and Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch and the Code of Jewish Law. If you take a look at source number 13, Maimonides, the Rambam says, one who obligates himself to pay an unspecified sum, as in, I am obligated to feed or clothe you for 5 years, is not obligated, even if a kinyan was made. It doesn't matter. This is like a gift without a known object. So my mentors have ruled. He says, for the reason we've talked about before, we don't think you're really serious when you do this. If there's no sum that's being specified, we don't take it seriously. However, Rabbi Yosef Karo disagreed. In source number 14, one who obligates himself to pay an unspecified sum, such as to feed or clothe someone for 5 years or without a specific number of years, is not bound, according to the Rambam, per Maimonides, even with a kinyan. All who came after Rambam disagreed with him, though, saying he is bound, and this is the law. It is considered to be a viable transaction. That's one point, though. Second point, if a married woman engages in this transaction, meaning even though all these sources we've seen have been worded in terms of the male, the truth is that they do apply for a female who is trying to do this as well. But you run into a particular problem, which is that when a woman passes away, letter of the law in Jewish law is that the husband is going to receive her property. Not all the property. There's some property she brought into the marriage, property that came in during the marriage. I'm not talking about the distinctions in that regard right now. But how are you going to manage this? So if you take a look at source number 15, the Litman and Reznikoff article, Jewish and American Inheritance Law, a husband is first in line to rent to inherit from his wife. In addition, however, a husband's rights are deemed to have vested at the outset of the marriage. That's the key point. I should have mentioned that before. The husband is already has a right to the property from the start of the marriage before the artificial debt was created. Consequently, even if during the marriage the woman were to admit a great debt to a third party, this would not affect the husband's rights. Given that his rights preceded the indebtedness to the third party, the husband would have prior rights to the wife's estate. Consequently, for a married woman to use this device, she needs her husband's cooperation. The husband should sign a separate admission of indebtedness that falls due on his wife's death. This document, however, should provide. This indebtedness is deemed fully paid and discharged if he fulfills the gift set forth in his wife's will. So, in other words, you create an obligation for him to go along with her will. And that's going to be needed in order for it to be effective.
There's something different on this anyway.
What do you mean?
Common law. And basically, you actually need a will because there's no provision of property.
Well, that's a separate overall problem, going back to what we had said in the beginning of the shiur. Correct.
But if it's common law, then it doesn't apply anything.
What doesn't apply?
Provision of property. If you have to have a will, or the other party cannot.
Right. No, that's true. But this isn't in lieu of a will. This is alongside the will. The issues here that you have to deal with, first of all, somebody mentioned consideration. So I note in source number 16 from Litman and Reznikoff, they're in American law, but it's the same thing. As a general rule, American law does not enforce an obligation or deem it legally binding when a person voluntarily undertakes an obligation to another without consideration or a consideration substitute. So you will need consideration from Reuven in our case. Number two, though, the tax consequences for this artificial debt. And that's source number 17. And this is where I come back to the point that Raquel, Rachel, and Abby were talking about before with Chuck, the viability of the agreement. In secular law, in terms of applicability to the contemporary American situation, this is Rabbi Jachter, one may ask if creating such a debt creates concern for tax consequences. Raphael Cohn wrote to me, he says, and Raphael Cohn is a major authority in Jewish law living in New York. He wrote to me that it is halachically feasible to name a charity, not a daughter, to help address such concerns. Meaning, instead of saying the usual way to do this, which we're going to talk about, in which the artificial debt is to one's daughter, instead, make the artificial debt to be to a particular charity, Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. I think that's a good option. So, just saying. I picked out of a hat. So he says, Rav J. David Bleich, in his contemporary version of this shtar, this document, adds a clause to address this concern that includes the statement, this instrument shall be regarded as of no effect whatsoever in any proceedings brought before any civil court of competent jurisdiction. How do you like that? he has a line in there saying, no, no effect whatsoever as far as they're concerned. There's nothing to see here. Move on. That's what he says. We should note that the fact that the document has no validity in civil law does not detract from its halachic validity. And he quotes you a series of sources in that regard. And he says, Machon Lahara, institution based, I think, in New York, advises that the executed shtar, the executed document, be kept with a third party, an Orthodox Jewish attorney who will store it with, who will store it with a will and or trust documents and present it only if the halachic heirs challenge the halachic validity of the secular will in a Beit Din. Don't use this unless you have to. Don't produce it, I should say, unless you have to use it, but don't produce it. But this is the artificial debt method. And now I want to show you a nuance, a slightly different version of it that's called in Hebrew, shtar chatzi zachar, which literally means a deed of half of a male. What in the world does that mean? So we already saw the reference to the idea that the artificial debt is not given to some random person, but the artificial debt is to one's daughter. And the idea is, well, you don't need to see the idea. Take a look at source number 18. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, also known as Rama, explains, and it's in the Code of Jewish Law, the practice of shtar chatzi zachar, writing for daughters that they should have a share like the males, written in the form of an admission that he owes a certain sum to her, and he will not be exempt other than by giving them a share like the males, and so he can even give her that which he does not currently own, whether that which his due, which is his due, or that which he currently has. So the idea is that he says, I am going to give my daughter a share in the estate. As he begins it, he says, a half share in the estate. Then he drops the half. I'm going to come back to that. But he says, I'm going to give my daughter a share in the estate. And the way that I'll do it is by declaring, I owe her a tremendous sum of money. And that's going to her unless they fulfill the terms of my estate, which includes giving my daughter the, a share. That's the idea. That's the suggestion. It's a version on the artificial debt idea. It just means that you're making specifically the daughter. I'm sorry, I'm seeing something here. Okay. So, got it. Okay. No, I thought someone was trying to talk to me, but I don't think they were. I think they were. Okay. So, again, the idea is the same as the artificial debt, but the artificial debt is specifically to one's daughter, unless the sons give part of the estate. That's the idea. Once again, we will need kinyan, in order for this to work. Now, Rabbi Isserles, in the beginning of his comments, said specifically, a half share. Why a half share? What is it about a half share? So Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, known as the Minchas Yitzchak, in source 19, said that that was intentional, that it should be half, and the reason is, a firstborn gets a double share over the other children in biblical law, so then give the sons a double share over what the daughter gets. It maintains a kind of hierarchy in the estate, which again, as I said in the beginning, is based on the idea that the sons have a greater responsibility, the firstborn have an even greater responsibility, and you give them portions that are commensurate to that. However, various halachic authorities have said that it doesn't need to be a half share, it can be a full share. The Ketzos HaChoshen, a classic commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, mentions a shtar shalem zachar, a document in which she gets a complete share like a male. And Rabbi Jachter, in source number 20, brings various authorities who say that it's absolutely appropriate to say full share. If you take a look at source number 20, there's someone here whose mic is unmuted, but I don't know if they're trying to tell me something or if it's just accidental, but it keeps unmuting. Did they? No? Okay. So if you take a look at source number 20, Rabbi Jachter says, we noted earlier that the Ketzot HaChoshen mentions the option of leaving a daughter a full share in the Yerusha, in the inheritance, and that's what I just mentioned. And that Rabbi Akiva Eger wrote such a document for his daughter upon her marriage to the Chasim Sofer, right? Rabbi Akiva Eger's daughter marries the Chasim Sofer, and he writes a document saying she's getting a full share. Rav Herschel Schechter, in turn, told me today one should give his daughters, I think it's told me that today one should give his daughters a full share in the Yerusha, in the inheritance, lest there be bitterness and acrimony in the family. Rav Schechter told me that he is following the lead of Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, who also gave such advice, as reported by Rav Meir Goldwicht. Indeed, Rav Yitzhak Herzog records that the famed author Shai Agnon reports that in pre-war Galicia, a great Hasidic Rebbe died and his sons asserted their halachic right to the entire inheritance, whereupon they received the stern disapproval of the entire regional Jewish community. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky expresses a similar sentiment, stating, in today's times, it is proper for the daughters to receive an appropriate share of the estate. It is not considered avurei achsanta, warping the order of inheritance. However, the son should also receive an appropriate share of the estate. Rav Chio Michal Tukachinsky espouses a similar approach. Rav Binyamin Rabinovich Tumen explains that in an age when women are expected to contribute to the financial well-being of their families, daughters also need a share in the Yerusha, in the inheritance. Many authorities writing that this should be so. It's very interesting because, remember in the beginning, I quoted you Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, the Rashba, and how angry he was at the suggestion that people should be following the law of the land for estate distribution. His subject there was about equalizing the shares of the sons and daughters, as I remember correctly. And he did not seem to feel that way. But 600 years later, 20th century authorities felt very much that this was and is an appropriate thing to do, and that continues into the 21st century authorities who are quoted here as well. So that is what I understand to be the most popular method of dealing with this, is some version of the artificial debt. I do want to mention two other approaches. I will note now, just in case anyone didn't hear it in the beginning, again, if you want a letter certifying that you were here, I need you to sign in with a message to me in the chat. Having registered in advance helps us with our paperwork because we have everything neatly lined up in a spreadsheet, but it doesn't get you a letter certifying you were here, so please make sure you send me a note. Okay, just once. The next method that I'm going to mention is joint tenancy, and I thank Rachel for her article, which explained this very nicely in Source 21. Take a look, please, at Source 21. Transferring and holding assets in joint tenancy with children during lifetime may be a solution to the halachic issue of distributing assets to daughters on death. However, in Canada, one must proceed cautiously. So let me just pause here for a second. The idea is that the property is owned by the transferor in tandem with the transferee. Rachel, I feel odd describing this with you right here. I don't know if you want to take over.
No, you're doing a good job.
Okay, but there are two notes here of concern. Number one, there may be tax implications to a transfer to joint tenancy where a true joint tenancy is created, as the parent may be considered to be disposing of one half of the property. That's number one. Number two, in light of the Pequor and Saylor decisions, if the property is transferred to one of several children, with the intention that the child is to distribute the property among several siblings, right? You create a joint tenancy with one of the kids and expect that, in the event of the death, that child is now going to distribute, the property may be considered to fall back into the estate, to be divided according to the will. That said, if, as discussed above, there had been a proper kinyan at the time of the transfer into joint tenancy, the child holding the property at the death of the parent should be able to distribute it in accordance with the will without offending the halacha. In other words, this second concern, that it goes back into the estate, so to speak, and that it has to be distributed by the will, is okay. Because if you're telling me that the property was given to the child who entered into joint tenancy, then it was a gift. It's now owned by the child, and they can give it to whoever they want. There is no problem in doing that. Just know that may happen. That's really what it comes down to. So that's another method of dealing with this is the joint tenancy method. And I think, as I understand it, the primary concern will be, as always, you need a Kenyan in order for this to work. And you have the potential tax consequences of creating this, this joint tenancy. Clear?
And if you do it for all the kids, the risk you run is if one of the kids predeceases his family or her family, who's that?
Right. I hear that. Thank you. Okay. Writing that into my notes as well. Okay. Last of our methods, the inter vivos trust. So Rabbi Jachter talks about this in source number 22. We referenced it earlier when I talked about mitzvah l'kayim hames, divrei hames, that there's a mitzvah of fulfilling the words of the deceased. Take a look at number 22, Rabbi Jachter's article with Martin Schenkman. A new suggestion may provide a halachically viable solution to the Yerusha inheritance issues in a manner that is consistent with common secular legal and estate planning. This involves establishing a revocable living trust. A revocable living trust is a contractual arrangement between oneself as the grantor forming the trust, preferably oneself and another person as co-trustees managing the trust, and oneself and his family members as beneficiaries to receive the economic benefits of the trust. So the transferor is actually receiving benefits also, along with everybody else, from this trust. This approach to a living trust is fundamentally different from the more simplistic approach of most living trusts, in which one will be the sole grantor, trustee, and beneficiary until death. The latter approach, that other approach, is less likely to be respected as a valid entity under halacha. If such a trust can be respected as a legal entity by halacha, if the transfers of one's assets to such a trust can be characterized as lifetime gifts under halacha, then this commonly used secular planning technique may afford an ideal method of complying with the Torah requirements concerning Yerusha, concerning inheritance. So the idea is, you create a living trust, the trustee has the power to spend the money on behalf of the beneficiaries, and there are instructions for how it should ultimately be distributed. And the idea is, mitzvah l'kayim hames, they should want to fulfill it. So I know of two problems. Number one, it's only going to work for property owned at the time that the trust is created. And number, that as a halachic concern, not a secular concern, but as a halachic concern. And then the other is tax implications of putting it in the trust. And Rachel, I know in your article you have suggestions of dealing with this via an alter ego trust, I think for people who are over 65, or a self-benefit trust for people who are under 65. I am not clear on whether the rules for use of the funds will comply with the halachic standards for recognizing the property as owned by the trustee. I am not clear on that. Can you comment?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure I understand.
I'm not clear that the rules for use of the funds will comply with the halachic standards for recognizing the property as owned by the trustee. In other words, it has to be owned by the trustee in order for it to work in halacha, right? Otherwise, it should go via...
Yeah, I mean, the trustee is has legal title to the property. They just have to... They can only use it for the benefit of the person who put it in.
Right, and that's my question. Does that make it theirs if all they're really doing is overseeing it, but they have no control of the property, you know, for their own ends?
No, I think it's just simply a bare trust, which a lot of times one of the issues here is the revocable living trust is really a U.S. concept,
mm-hmm.
that we don't do those kinds of trusts here. So you'd have to really adapt what they're talking about to Canadian circumstances. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the trustee has title to the property and can buy and sell and make distributions to the beneficiaries, but they can only use it for the benefit of those beneficiaries. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So again, we've seen these different methods, going through, you know, just naming them, the future inter vivos gift with retained life interest, the artificial debt, the variation on that, by saying the artificial debt is to the daughter, if they don't give her a half share or a full share, the joint tenancy idea, and then this inter vivos trust. Very, very important to note, to reiterate what I said earlier, any solution should be implemented with the help of an experienced rabbinical advisor working with the lawyer. The halachic aspects of drafting such a document really aren't terribly complicated. It's not like, oh no, this can't be understood. But if you don't know the procedure well, you can ruin it. So that's why I say it should be somebody who really, really knows what they're doing, drafting this. Okay. Yes, Chuck.
Just shortly, I would also suggest involving an accountant.
Okay.
Because the tax consequences of this are severe. Mm-hmm. And I think Rachel can comment as well as which trusts fall under the 21-year-old, so somebody should live to 120. What happens with the trust and the tax consequences at the end of 21 years? And then also the immediate tax consequences with what's going on with whatever assets are moved into the trust.
Right. Okay.
Right. So really the only kind of trust you'd want to do this with is an alter ego or trust where you're dealing with somebody who's 65 or over.
Mm-hmm.
Without, because then you don't have those kinds of tax consequences.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. The last issue, disinheriting. So the vignette, if you go back to the beginning of the source sheet, David's son Sam has stopped observing Judaism, and David is concerned that his grandchildren will not be raised as Jews at all. David wishes to structure his will to exclude Sam, unless Sam would send his children to Jewish schools. Would Jewish law approve of this? Would this be legal in Ontario? So is Ontario good with this? Is Judaism good with this? So the problem is this. As I understand it, the preference of the law is to say that the children have a right to the estate. I always find this very funny. I made a point about this 6 years ago, that on the one hand, we say the children have a right to the estate as though it's already theirs, and on the other hand, the government is going to tax the inheritance as a transfer. Either it's theirs or it's not theirs, but apparently that's not true. It's theirs, but the government is getting a share anyway. So in the case of disinheriting, one might run into real problems because the children have a right to the estate. We don't have the time right now to go into this in depth, but I am going to quote you from source number 23, Chuck's article, "When is a disappointed heir a defrauded creditor?" A seminal case in this area is Stone v. Stone. In 1995, multimillionaire Harry Stone hatched a plan to ensure that his wife of 24 years, Sarah Stone, would get very little upon his death. In particular, Harry wanted to make sure that his commercial wealth would go to his children from a prior marriage. The problem for Harry, of course, was the Family Law Act, which lets the surviving spouse seek equalization against the estate in the same way that a spouse might on a divorce. So she wants her appropriate share. Harry tried to thwart his wife's rights under the Family Law Act by transferring his assets to his children before he died. This is not a halachic will. This is just general. The result was that when Harry passed away on July 21st, 1995, there was virtually nothing left in his estate. Essentially, Harry was preventing his wife from exercising her claim under the Family Law Act for an equalization of net family property, because there is no family property. In this case, Ontario Court of Appeal recognized the possibility of using the Fraudulent Conveyances Act to set aside transfers, quote, made with intent to defeat, hinder, delay, or defraud creditors or others of their just and lawful action suits, debts, accounts, damages, penalties, or forfeitures. So you can't give away your property in a way that cheats somebody of their right. In Stone v. Stone, the court held that as a spouse who held rights under the Family Law Act at the time of the fraudulent conveyances, i.e. the right to seek equalization, Sarah was a creditor or other within the meaning of the Fraudulent Conveyances Act. Accordingly, Harry's transfers to his kids were declared void. Sarah received an equalization payment of almost $1 million. So the point here is that trying to disinherit somebody may well run afoul of of the courts, which are going to say you've cheated them of their due. And if you take a look at source number 24 in her article, Rachel writes, "The Jewish laws of inheritance and estate planning in Canada, it is unlikely for observant Jews in Western societies to want to execute wills that are strictly in keeping with the biblical laws of inheritance. Not only would such a will be viewed as unfair and likely to cause discord in a family," which we'll talk about in a few minutes, "in many jurisdictions, secular laws may be applied to overturn such distributions." It wasn't fair. So a secular court, depending on your jurisdiction, and I know not all provinces are the same in this regard, and that's, you know, something I'm avoiding deliberately, but in your jurisdiction, they may say, we don't approve of disinheriting the child unless the child did certain things that will justify the disinheriting, but the courts will recognize as justifying it. What about Judaism? So on the one hand, Judaism seems to consider the Torah's order of inheritance as very, very important. And therefore, we do not want disinheriting to happen. If you take a look at source number 25, we find a source from the Talmud in Bava Batra. Mishnah says, this is a core text in the Talmud, one can write away his property to others, leaving his children. A person can give all his property to somebody else while still alive. But the sages are displeased with such a person. The phrase in the Hebrew, Ein ruach hachamim nocha himenu, can be translated in a couple of different ways. I believe this is the accurate translation. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, he is remembered for the good if his children were not behaving properly. He says, not so fast. You know, if the kid isn't behaving well, then maybe you're justified about, for not leaving him the property. But as a general rule, as a general principle, we do seem to adopt this idea that we do not want parents to warp the order of inheritance. I brought you a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud in source number 26. Rabbi Abba Bar Mamal said, regarding one who writes his property to others, leaving his sons, it is written, and he quotes you a verse from Yeshaya, from Isaiah, and their sins were upon their bones. He is disapproving in a very serious way. So much so that in the event that somebody says before he dies, I want you to do what is good with my assets, whatever that means, we are taught I'm just looking to see, yes, I did bring it on here. Take a look at source number 27, Rabbi Yeshua Falk in the Sma, a commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. He says this, the fact that we don't want the property written away to others is because the Torah's portion of inheritance assigns to the heirs the right to stand in the place of those who bequeath to them in their lot and inheritance. This is automatically theirs. Effectively, there is a right to the estate. As a result, we say don't veer, don't deviate. And Maimonides writes in number 28, one who gives his property to others, leaving the heirs, displeases the sages, even if the heirs do not act properly to him. The others, whoever it is that they wrote it to, do acquire whatever he gives them. So in other words, if you disinherit the kids, it's effective. It's just not a good thing to do. It is pious to refrain from serving as witness to a will that transfers inheritance from the heir. Even from a son who does not act properly to a brother who is wise and acts properly. You have one heir. They're both halachic heirs. One is a son, one is a brother. Don't transfer it from the bad son to the good brother. And that business about serving as a witness is actually coming from source number 33, which we'll hopefully get to in just a minute or two, because we're running low on time. There's a lot to be said about this. There's a lot of responsa on this question of disinheriting. Is it actually prohibited? Is it simply being discouraged? Is it only wrong if one gives to non-heirs, you know, people who aren't in the Torah's line of inheritance? Is it only if you disinherit them entirely? There's a lot of literature on this. But now I'm going to go the other way and say that Jewish authorities did recognize that veering from the order of inheritance may well make sense at various times. So if you take a look at source number 29, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, if a healthy person wishes to distribute his assets after his death to prevent fighting among his heirs, and he wishes to arrange the instructions while he is healthy, whatever system he uses, he must assign it with an act of kinyan. An act of kinyan is required while still alive. My point, though, in bringing it is, why would somebody wish to do this? To prevent fighting among the heirs. It's about keeping the peace. Sometimes keeping the peace means you change the order of inheritance. Sometimes it's about meeting the needs of the heirs. A person has 3, 4, 5 heirs of equal claim, and one of them needs the property a lot more than the others do. We have a Torah mitzvah of tzedakah to family members, and maybe it's important to support the one whose needs are greater. Obviously, this can lead to fights in the family. You got to be really careful when you play this game, but that may be a justification. Another reason to deviate would be in order to avoid giving the children too much property. We believe in the principle of Yeshuvo Shel Olam, settling the world. And we are taught that people who have nothing to do get into trouble. It's a Mishnah Ink to vote to that effect. So for that reason, take a look at source number 30, story from the Talmud. Reish Lakish, one of the leading sages in the Talmud, passed away. He left behind a measure of saffron. That was all he had left in his property at that point. He had disposed of everything else. That was it. Now, saffron's expensive. That was all he left. He applied to himself this verse from Psalms, and they left their strength to others. He was not happy that he had left property to be distributed. He didn't want to leave anything behind. Another passage, source number 31. Rav said to Rav Hemnuna, "My son, if you possess something, then it is good for you. For in Sheol, in the grave, there is no pleasure, and death does not delay." So he says, if you have something, that's good. There's no pleasure, you know, after this world, so in any of your assets, so, you know, it's good. And should you say, I will leave a portion for my son, I don't want to use it for myself, I want to make sure my kid gets it, who's going to tell you what happens to it in Sheol? What are you going to know from what happens afterwards? Better to enjoy it now. He says, don't leave it to the kids. So, you know, again, everyone has to know their family situation and their children in order to make an assessment like this. But that's another factor leading towards saying, deviate from the order of inheritance. Another factor is philanthropy. Take a look at source number 32, please. When Mar Ukva, one of the sages, was dying, he instructed, bring me my tzedakah account. He found 7,000 dinari siyanki recorded therein. It's a large sum of money. He said, my provisions are light and my path is long. He says, I don't have enough merits with me to go to the next world. So he stood up and gave away half of his money. Gives away half. To which the Talmud challenges, you're not allowed to do that. The sages enacted that one who gives tzedakah may not give more than 20%. So how are you allowed to give 50%? To which they answer, no, that's only when one is alive, lest he become impoverished. Because we don't want him to become a burden on the community. But after death, there's no such concern. Go ahead. You can give it away. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in the Aruch HaShulchan explained why 50% specifically. He said the idea is that a person is considered her own closest relative. You are your own closest relative. So essentially, what you're doing by giving away 50% is saying, I'm giving half to myself by giving tzedakah, and half to the rest of the family. That's the way that was rationalized. So now what we've seen is, from a secular perspective, disinheriting is going to get you in trouble depending on your jurisdiction, more or less trouble, but it can definitely be a problem. Jewish law, on the one hand, says don't deviate from the order of inheritance. On the other hand, it recognizes that there may be need, there may be reasons to give away in ways that vary from the order of inheritance. So the general assumption is that you should not thwart the order of inheritance. And I brought you in source number 3, Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, Shinina, which is usually translated as sharp one, but it may actually mean the one with the long teeth. That's its own discussion. Do not be among those who divert inheritance, even from a bad son to a good son. You don't know what sort of child may emerge from him. However, even though he said don't do it, we still say you could deviate, as long as you do something to satisfy the regular order of inheritance, and the way that it's done is with a codicil in the will stating that a particular sum will be distributed according to the Torah's order of inheritance. Not a gift, but actually as inheritance. What should that amount be? I know the question that people want to ask. Let me just get through this and then I'll address it. What should that sum be? So a classic source on this is found in Source 34, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran, in 15th century Algeria, at the end of a responsum, writes, in early template documents, they noted that the deceased left 4 zuz to his heirs. If you want to know how much 4 zuz is, consider that on Pesach night, we say that for 2 zuz, you can get a yearling goat. So 2 yearling goats is what they would leave to their heirs. One Gaon, one of the sages in the period, call it 7th to 10th century, explained that this was to satisfy the sages, leave 4 zuz. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, quoting earlier authorities in source number 35, said it should be a significant amount. It should be a significant amount. That's what he goes with. In source 36, I brought you the Pinchei Choshen. I forgot to put the name on it. It's Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who was a judge in Israel and one of the leading authorities in financial matters until he passed away a few years ago, addresses the question of amount. And he says, in practice, I have not seen a resolution for this. I don't know what the amount should be. Still, it appears this depends on the magnitude of the general inheritance. Logically, it appears if there are a lot of assets and one leaves the heirs $1 or even 4 zuz, this is ridiculous. So it depends on how much the estate is and the state of the heirs. Are they poor or wealthy? The matter is subject to the perspective of the judge. And in my humble opinion, when they said one must leave to the heirs, that means to leave it in the manner of automatic inheritance, like the law of the Torah. It isn't enough to say, I'm just going to give them a gift. It has to be as inheritance. But one who divides up all his assets, even though he gives his heirs an amount suitable for the remnant, he has still uprooted the order of inheritance. He says, giving a gift doesn't qualify. It should be left as an inheritance. So someone will ask, someone indeed asked me in an email before this session, what if you write up such a clause, such a codicil in the will, but you know that it's not going to fly. It's not going to be accepted when the will is actually carried out, because it's following the Torah's order of inheritance, and it says the sons get, then the daughters aren't going to get. Does that matter? And I think the answer is no. I think it's still a valid way to do it. The point is, you attempt to leave them a bequest in the way that the Torah wants it done, and then what happens, happens. But you have to make your effort to do it that way. That's my understanding of what one should do if one is in fact deviating from the Torah's order of inheritance. Leave something to be distributed that way. Okay, it is 8:58. We have 2 minutes for questions. I'm going to stay on after. Don't worry, I'm not running out just yet. But I want to thank everybody for participating. I do want to reiterate to sign in with a message to me in the chat. December 12th, Sunday morning, 9:30 to 11, is our last session for 2021. It will be shepherding Jewish families through family law litigation. In particular, as I said in the beginning, if anyone could give me advice on things that families should be told or that lawyers should think about in shepherding families through family law litigation, I would love to hear from you. Send me an email, please. And now I'll take questions and comments. It was that good. I could have used the last 2 minutes. Okay. Well, thank you very much, everybody. And I wish you a good night.
Good night.
Okay. Be well.
Rabbi, you covered it all. What can we say?
Pretty sure that's not true, but okay. Thank you.